KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland. I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
Coming up, a look inside San Francisco's dog court.
I've seen big, strong, tough-looking guys just cry. Tears just gushing out because they're going to lose their dog.
Then we'll turn to the sky for a look at the world of pigeon racing.
Generally, the birds are going to be flying about 45 miles an hour, depending on whether they have a headwind, a tailwind, or sidewind.
And we'll see what happens when the often invisible disorders of autism and Asperger's syndrome go undiagnosed in prison.
In jail, my court-appointed attorney told me, "Joe, we want to test you for Asperger's." And I said, "What is that?" Because at first I thought he said asparagus.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. There's Wi-Fi and Tesla, Cheerios and Cocoa Puff. There are three by the name of Clinton and 13 Bernies. Those are just some of the names of registered dogs residing in San Francisco. The city's 120,000 canines famously outnumber its children. But put that many cuddly companions in one smallish region, and it's inevitable that some of these four-legged family members will act out, snap, bite, and attack. To decide what to do when pets turn violent, there's dog court. KALW's Holly J. McDeed explains.
Dorothy Chan's dog, a Shiba Inu named Sammy, was attacked outside the Palace of Fine Arts last winter.
So Sammy's just walking around here, and I'm doing this. I'm looking at him. And then all of a sudden, whoosh!
Poor Sammy was nearly killed. Now Chan wants revenge. She wants the dog who bit him, a pit bull named Ajax, sentenced to death. So Chan came here to a hearing room at San Francisco City Hall, where dog court is in session. Chan drops down and rolls around in front of the judge's bench to recreate the dog fight.
So I'm going like this. I think it's like this. And then I'm going like this.
A cop broke up the brawl, and the frightened Spitz dashed into the street.
I'm like, oh my gosh, he went that way. Yes, so I'm running. Sammy
survived, but the future is less certain for the pit bull who pounced on him. The judge, hearing officer Jeff Foster, will decide Ajax's fate. But first, he hears from all sides.
So, what do you have to say about Ajax?
Jemmy Langit, Ajax's owner, says he's never had a problem in the 8 years they've been together.
I've had Ajax for over 8 years with no incidents such as this ever occurring.
Langit says he went on vacation and left Ajax with the dog sitter. He told the sitter to keep the pit bull in a muzzle, but she did not listen. She actually handed Ajax's leash to a tourist so she could take a photo of the Palace of Fine Arts, and Ajax escaped. In this moment, Foster is not impressed by humankind.
Once again, it's the humans that are involved in this that have created this whole problem. You know, we would prefer not to penalize the dog. I would prefer to penalize you.
At dog court, Foster can't impose fines or jail time. That's because legally, dogs are nothing more than a piece of property, like TVs or coffee tables. And the law can't punish people for not taking care of their coffee tables.
It's a piece of property, is the way that the government and law treats a dog. It's a piece of property. So they don't think about the owner's actions in this situation. They just think about, this is a piece of property that can actually bite. So we're going to do something to the property rather than to the humans involved.
But Foster can try to convince owners to be more careful by threatening to take away or euthanize their dogs. In this case, he opts for leniency. He orders the owner to enroll Ajax in training classes and to use more reliable dog sitters. If he doesn't follow through, the dog will be branded vicious and dangerous. That's a legal term that requires even more regulatory hoops.
It has to be tattooed. You have to post signs all around your house that say, warning, dangerous dog. You have to register with the city, which costs, and all of that.
Like judges in human court, Foster thinks first about public safety when he issues his rulings. But he also thinks about a hotel tycoon named Leona Helmsley, who left $12 million to her spoiled Maltese. He considers those kinds of relationships when he hands down his rulings.
It's a really excellent example of how people anthropomorphize their dogs. They turn them into humans. I've seen big, strong, tough-looking guys just cry. Tears just gushing out because they're going to lose their dog because they love that dog.
Throughout the hearing, Officer Ryan Crockett sits at attention. Crockett is the San Francisco Police Department's one-man vicious and dangerous dog unit. He gets about 10 phone calls a day related to bites and nips. Hearings like these have been happening in San Francisco since the 90s. But for years, Crockett says, no one really took dog court seriously.
911. Yes, I'm just arrested. We have two dogs rampaging out in the hall.
In 2001, everything changed. In this 911 call, a woman pleads for help as she witnesses through the peephole on her door two massive dogs mauling her neighbor, Diane Whipple, to death.
Please hurry. I hear her screaming, and I don't dare open the door. These dogs are ferocious.
The thing that kind of sparked the unit to being bigger and having more hearings was when Diane Whipple was actually, you know, killed by a dog in her apartment complex.
It was a gruesome and bizarre case. The dog's owners bred the Presa Canarios for their adopted son, who was a white supremacist gang member serving life in prison. After the tragic mauling, SFPD created a vicious and dangerous dog unit, and dog court hearings ramped up.
The dog unit from then on, you know, took it to the next level to make sure that that would never, ever, ever, ever happen again. Some counties will just have where it's one person and it's a closed-door session. Here, I think it's a really well-oiled machine.
Crockett says the system keeps mean mutts from falling through the cracks. Anyone can request a hearing about a dog they believe is a public safety threat.
Either you need to do something about your dog's behavior and fix it, or the city's going to do something to protect everyone.
Back at dog court, Jeff Poster has more difficult decisions to make.
Can you tell me what happened on the day that you were bitten?
Yeah.
Kind of take me through it.
Yes.
With her arm in a sling, Christina Kaiser takes the stand to describe how her elderly Chow Chow, Otis, was charged by a pit bull named Zeus.
It was not a friendly, like, I'm excited to see you sort of situation. It was like, I'm going for your jugular situation.
When Kaiser tried to defend her pet, the pit bull bit her arm. She needed more than a dozen stitches. Officer Foster asked her what she thinks should happen to Zeus.
It, like, kills me to think of what I assume is being suggested. I can't say what I would want for that dog.
She doesn't want to be the person to decide his fate.
I love pit bulls. I have had many friends who've had amazing pit bulls who are the most loving, caring dogs I've ever met. And I don't think it's the dog issue. If you have an aggressive dog, you need to take care of it.
The pit bull went for the Chow Chow's neck and underbelly, then grabbed him by the leg and shook him hard. Otis has puncture wounds in his leg and still has a limp. Zeus's owners, Jenna Sowar and James Green, had left their pit bull with a friend, and he wiggled out of his collar and escaped.
I'm like, no way. I was like, really? He did that? Like, he's never been aggressive toward other people, ever.
Police say Zeus was likely used as a bait dog in bloody dog fights before Ware and Green adopted him from someone on Craigslist. They say they'd do anything for Zeus. Green is near tears.
I don't want to see my dog die. I don't have children, so he's my child.
They didn't seem to do a great job of parenting. Ware tells the court that training pit bulls is a lifelong hobby of hers. But she's never taken her dogs to obedience school, and she says she can't afford a muzzle. Foster says he interprets Zeus's behavior as aggression that can't be held back.
The fact that the dog was going for the throat and then down into the body, because then he wants to just eviscerate it.
Days later, Foster issues a verdict. Zeus must be put down. Later, Foster explained that if he let Zeus live, he'd need to be isolated from people and animals for safety until the end of his dog days. This was only the second dog he's decided to put down in the past year. He says that kind of ruling keeps him up at night, but he has to consider public safety and how devastated the victim was because she couldn't protect her vulnerable Chow Chow from harm's way.
She's crying so much because she's thinking about her dog. She's thinking about the attack that her dog got. She doesn't care that she's got 15 stitches in her arm. She's worried that her dog's limping now. That's the stuff that gets you.
In a dog-loving city like San Francisco, Foster says he strives to take into account the bond between people and animals.
They love us no matter what. That's just the way dogs are. Dogs' whole goal in life is to make you happy. And if you learn how to properly show them how to do that, you will have the best dog in the world.
There's hundreds of dogs in San Francisco, looking for homes, tails wagging, tongues on full display, eager for attention and affection and treats. On top of all that, some of them might need a responsible owner who knows when to use a muzzle. Zeus is gone now, but owner Jenessa Ware is still suffering from puppy love. She says she's devastated to lose her dog, but she's not going to cry about it. She's already thinking of adopting a replacement. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Holly is our justice reporter. Reach out to her at justice@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Pigeons have a bad reputation. You know, rats with wings. But did you know these birds are also master navigators? Perhaps the single most famous pigeon of them all is Cher Ami. He was a carrier pigeon during the First World War, whose heroic flight through enemy fire saved 194 lives and earned him a medal from the French government. Look it up. Nowadays, it's no longer the norm for pigeons to deliver messages, but their navigation skills can win them big money. In the racing world, Geraldine Asu tells us more.
I'm standing at the entrance of what looks like a small white house on stilts. It's a pigeon loft. There's a ladder, a door, and a whole lot of cooing. Meet Bill Milestone, a second-generation San Franciscan pigeon racer. He's whistling to let the birds know lunch is ready.
A happy pigeon has a lot of energy. The eye has a sparkle. And oftentimes they like to squabble with the other birds. And it shows.
Milestone's training his flock of 40 for an upcoming race.
Each bird ideally has its own perch and has its own nest box. And with clean water and good food, they'll be happy. If the birds are happy, you can take them quite a distance and they'll come home.
When Bill says quite a distance, he's not just talking about his birds flying around the block. He's talking miles, hundreds of miles, across state lines.
Shorter races in the Bay Area are out into Nevada. There's 200, 250, 300 miles. And we go out to up towards Idaho for the longer races, all the way to Council, which is 600 miles.
Here's how it all flies. At the beginning of a race, each bird gets a racing number that ties around its leg. The competitors are then rounded up, loaded onto a truck, which delivers them to a designated start line. Finally, on the big day, 30 minutes after sunrise, on your mark, get set, release the birds.
Generally, the birds are going to be flying about 45 miles an hour, depending on whether they have a headwind, a tailwind, or side wind. But you can predict pretty close as to when the winners will be coming home.
Milestone says that a bird can fly up to 600 miles in one day.
Each bird is flying a slightly different distance, or at least the birds in from any particular loft. So whichever bird makes the most yards per minute in that particular race will be the winner.
Pigeons actually use the Earth's magnetic fields as their internal GPS system, following the strength of these invisible poles to determine direction. But aside from being able to find their way home, the birds also have to want to come home. And there's a lot of ways to do this. According to Milestone, there's one way that works pretty well.
There is a system called widowhood. Shall we say, the males and females are paired up in their own nest boxes. They establish their territory, and then they are separated.
Separated. This stress can act as a strong motivator because typically pigeons will mate for life. That's right. They're birds of a feather that stick together, even taking shifts to warm their eggs. Both male and female pigeons are used for racing, but widowhood is used only for males.
Generally speaking, the males are more interested in coming back to the hens, and the hens are more interested in coming back to their babies or the eggs.
In widowhood, trainers will separate the male bird from his mate a few days prior to the race. Then, right before the truck arrives, they reunite the lovebirds just before hauling the male to the start line. So that bird's got one thing on his mind.
There she is, I gotta get back. So the bird that is racing wants to come back to his nest box, and when he arrives there, the hen is waiting for him, and that motivates him to full performance.
But living in the Bay Area, it's not always easy to get back.
Pigeons naturally have a tendency to avoid crossing water. So the birds have to be trained specifically to be able to cross the bay here. Some die-hard pigeon racers have gone so far as to let their birds out from a boat in the middle of the bay. I usually just go over to Treasure Island.
And you definitely want a bird that will cross the water, because a winning bird could mean a lot of money. At the 2015 San Francisco Bay Area Triple Crown Pigeon Race, winning bird Sierra Miss flew home and earned over $16,000. Right now, these pigeons are on their off-season, training for their next race. That means eating high-protein diets and exercising, flying around at least once, sometimes twice a day.
So, it's okay, I'll let them out right now.
And then how long do they stay out for?
They'll be up there for about an hour.
Is that them?
Yeah, there they go.
For Cross Currents, I'm Geraldine Osu.
That story originally aired in January of 2016, back when Geraldine was a member of our Audio Academy training program. We're accepting applications for the next class right now. Find more info on the front page at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. We're going to end our show with a story from our partners at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Autism is extremely hard to diagnose because it can't be tested using blood or genes. It's a behavioral disorder. Often a parent or teacher has to notice the signs and request a child be tested. Many people are living their lives without realizing they have autism, and this includes people in prison. Incarcerated reporter Kelton O'Connor brings us this story of a fellow inmate who's been living with autism for years without knowing it. It took him coming to San Quentin to get diagnosed.
My name is Joseph Crowder. I'm 34 years old. I'm serving a sentence of 15 years to life for second-degree murder. I've served 13 years of that sentence so far, and I'm a high-functioning autistic with Asperger's syndrome. It first came to my attention that I might be autistic when I was arrested at 23 years old. In jail, my court-appointed attorney told me, "Joe, we want to test you for Asperger's." And I said, "What is that?" Because at first I thought he said asparagus. He said, "It's a type of high-functioning autism." I was shocked and just said, "Okay." When my lawyer approached me with the test, he said, "Joe, you don't got it. We got to figure something else out for your defense." I believed him. I did nothing. I gave up. And years later, I figured out that the original test stated that it needed to be further investigated before a definite affirmation. I decided to seek further testing and diagnosis. When I talked to my mom on the phone one day, her friend's son looked like me, talked like me, and acted exactly like me. And my mom's girlfriend said, well, gosh, I hope not. And my mom said, well, why not? And she said, because my son has autism. And so my mom said, I'm going to send you some books that she recommended. The Complete Guide to Asperger Syndrome spelled out my life from A to Z. It was a shock because I went in as a cynic going, I didn't have it. My lawyer told me I didn't have it. It sparked a fire in me to seek diagnosis and testing to see what is going on and what I can do to get better and fix what's broken. I was rejected for testing and diagnosis at 4 prisons when I was in reception at High Desert. I just told them I might have a comprehension problem, and they just gave me a picture test. And when I picked out all the flaws in it, they said, you're fine. Several months later, I went to their mental health clinician and I asked him if I could be tested for Asperger syndrome. He said, well, you don't have Asperger's. I can tell just by looking at you. And I said, well, I have these books that say otherwise. And he said, well, I don't care about your books. Do you hear voices? I said, no. He said, do you see things that aren't there? And I said, no. And he said, you're not my problem, Mr. Crowder. See yourself to the door. I attempted to give it one more shot. When I got called for mental health, the original interview was with a nurse. She said, well, we don't do that type of testing here. That was the same song and dance they had given me at CMC at High Desert. And I said, okay, that figures. And she said, besides, you're just misreading social cues. How important is that in prison? I thought it was kind of important. The negative drawbacks as a high-functioning autistic would be the lack of theory of mind. A common name for it is called mind blindness, meaning that I cannot tell what a person is thinking or feeling at any given time, unless I use pattern recognition, which means I recognize something that will trigger a recognition of, this means that they're angry or sad or hungry. But most of the time, I don't know what people are thinking or feeling. Therefore, I do not know whether or not I am annoying them, hurting them, making them happy, sad, etc. My original clinician that pulled me into the mental health program pushed for my diagnosis and testing because she saw how emotionally disrupted and depressed I was. I was going down in flames. I was in an emotional toilet. And she used whatever juice she had to push for the testing, and they tested me. I was tested and diagnosed here at San Quentin for high-functioning autism, Asperger syndrome, in 2015. After I was diagnosed, I was in treatment for a year before I discovered that there was a psychiatrist who specialized in autism in the office directly next door to my intern clinician. When I began treatment with her, it felt like I had won the lottery. She knew exactly what I needed. She was a stranger, and I like broke down and cried in front of her. It was so much gratitude. She had been working for CDCR for at least 10 years, and she told me that I was the very first autistic in prison that she had worked with. The system can very easily develop protocols and therapies for autistics in prison. It's not hard. It's not expensive. It's my belief that there are several thousand autistics incarcerated in prison. The consequences, I think, for autistics that are left untreated in prison, I give it a 99 percentile negative reaction. Without theory of mind and positive social interaction, the thoughts and patterns that become ingrained in an autistic mind are so concreted that they don't change. It's not that they can't, but it's that without proper guidance or treatment, the quality of life would be terrible. Their criminality would continue. Their untreated, undocumented anger problems, depression problems, hypersensitivities, they would possibly go to extremes in order to treat themselves, not even knowing what was the true problem. For those of you that struggle to seek help and aid and therapies in the prison system, don't give up hope. For every 10 people that don't care, there's at least 2 that do. I got to this prison and I got rescued and I got diagnosed, and it can happen. You know, I didn't believe it could happen. And then my life changed. And things are much better than they ever have been, ever. Even when I was free.
San Quentin Radio is a project in which KALW editors work with inmates to tell stories inside the prison. San Quentin officials listen to and approve the script and audio for this story prior to broadcast. Thanks to Sam Robinson and Larry Schneider for their help. That's our show today. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Truk Nguyen, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sojico, Gabe Graben, and James Rollins. The line producer is Liza Veal, with help from Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. You're listening to The Breathing Room. This Berkeley rock and roll band will play the Ivy Room in Albany tomorrow night. Show starts at 6 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.